Before we get going tonight, I just wanted to put this up front about the relationship between this podcast and Narsal. Larry and I both do volunteer work for Narsal, but this podcast is of our own creation. I asked Narsal to help promote it as a favor. That is the extent of the relationship between the two organizations. If you're mad at us for being political, by all means be mad at us, not Narsal. However, on that note, if you disagree with me or Larry, feel free to be specific, write comments, email, and hey, maybe we would have you on the show so you could duke out the issues. I hope you enjoy the show. Recording live from the super secret FYP studios, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 57 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. Coming to you from my super duper froggy voice. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm doing fine. I think my voice is okay for the moment.
Oh yeah, yours is fine. I'm talking about mine. I've had a cold for the last week.
Well, that's what you get when you circumnavigate the entire continental lower 48.
Yeah, I guess that might be. You end up touching all the gross people with all the germs, and I caught something from someone.
And I just stay here in the secret studios, and I don't have that problem.
Yeah, we are definitely recording in the hidden FYP studios bunker in an undisclosed location. The military couldn't track us down in here.
Well, it is pretty much a bunker here.
it's got like 1950s shag carpet. The sound acoustics in here are amazing.
And there's only one opening for light, and that's it for this place.
It's like a prison cell. Just a little bit well accommodated. Hey, so during the past week or so, the last 2 weeks, we've received a couple new patrons. We have a pair of Jeffs. We have Jeff M and Jeff G, both coming in at the beggar level, and totally appreciate you guys very, very much. Welcome to the Registry Matters family.
Well, welcome, Jeff and Jeff.
One of them is well known. You know who it is also. The other one, I couldn't tell you who he is. Jeff G, we definitely both know. But again, thank you guys very much. It's really humbling and very much appreciated that you guys will reach out and support the podcast.
Beggar level is fantastic.
Absolutely. So is the indigent level. Any level is fine. Even a dollar. I don't care. I just want the numbers, really. The numbers, the show of support is more important than the dollar value.
Well, isn't it the more we have of patrons, doesn't that trigger something good for us of the people watching the podcast?
It very well might. I don't know if that one specifically, but that brings up something I was going to bring up later. Something that I would like to initiate a campaign, just like we did with the YouTube subscribers to get the name channel, to help people find the podcast. But all of you, like hundreds of listeners, if you would go to the various places, if you would go to iTunes, if you would go to Stitcher, if you would go to like Google and leave a review of the podcast, it would hopefully a 5-star review. If you don't like the podcast, you could just forget that I said a word to you. So anyway, that would help out a lot if you would go to those places. I will put locations in the show notes and on the website to make it easier to find where to leave these reviews and such. We did get a question from Dave. He's one of our longest patrons, and he has a question regarding being removed from the registry. His question is, if one is removed from the registry by the appellate court in one state and then moves to another, must one register in the new state? And we were talking about this beforehand, and there might not be enough detail, so I guess we have to get Larry to give us, I don't know, the 12 different scenarios that this applies to.
Keep it to two, Andy, for now. And when he says by the appellate court, there's a couple different ways you could be removed by an appellate court. In the states that have a removal process after you've been on for the requisite amount of time, you could request that process to be removed, and you could appeal that, and the appeal could be denied or it could be granted. The initial stage, they could say, no, you don't qualify for removal. And the appellate court could say, yes, actually the lower court got it wrong, and you qualify for removal from state X. And let's just say hypothetically Georgia, if you went through that process and you got removed through the process from Georgia court, that has absolutely no impact on another state. Their definition of a registrant would still control. So if that Georgian who got removed pursuant to the official code of Georgia section, which is escaping me at the moment. If they moved to Wyoming, they would be defined as a sex offender by Wyoming law. And if Wyoming law defines that person as a sex offender, what Georgia did is of no relevance. The other scenario I can describe would be if the person was appealing the actual conviction that put them on the registry from the get-go. If the appellate court were to grant them relief and either declare the statute unconstitutional or declare something defective about the conviction and overturn the conviction, in almost all circumstances, that would be binding because in most states, a conviction is required to be on the registry. So if the conviction itself went away, and I'm not talking about the nuances of if you have a sealed conviction after a requisite amount of time, I'm talking about if the conviction itself were to be nullified by either a declaration of a deficient statute or a deficient process that resulted in a conviction and the trial were to be thrown out or the plea would be thrown out and you no longer have the conviction, then that would generally be binding on the other state. We could go on and on with scenarios that would keep you on the registry. If you were found not guilty by insanity, for example, you don't have a conviction because that's what the not guilty verdict did. It found you not guilty of the criminality by virtue of a mental defect. In most states, you would still have to register because the facts, in order to be found not guilty by reason of insanity, there has to be proof that you actually did. Hinckley had to have been proven to have attempted to assassinate Reagan before he could be found not guilty by insanity. So the underlying facts are established before you ever get to the determination that the person is not responsible by their mental defect. So in some cases, that would still keep the person on the registry. But in most cases, without a conviction, you would no longer have an obligation to register.
It's interesting the way that you word a lot of that. We have an article coming up from a man, and I don't want to get into the details. We'll cover that in a minute. But he was exonerated by DNA evidence, and he is having a hard time getting off the parole board. Will not let him off of the registration status.
Well, we'll have to take a look at that shortly.
Right. Well, Dave, if you want to ask something more pointed or if you want to reach out and get in touch with Larry directly, let me know, and we'll try and get the two of you hooked up. I know that there was a lot of ambiguity in the way that your question was left to get Larry to leave a specific kind of answer. Over on Twitter, there's a woman that I've been speaking to. She's in the wonderful state of Florida, and her son is trying to get into college. And she sent me a picture of the admissions letter where I know I'm going to get some of the details wrong, but I believe that he was accepted into the school. But at the time he wasn't allowed to use the internet, and then that status changed. Maybe he came off parole and then he was allowed to use a computer, whatever. Then the college has denied him. And so, like I said, she gave a copy of the admissions letter where they denied denied him access to the school. It says, based on information provided, the admissions committee determined it would be best interest of the college to deny your request for admission. And then as a closing line that says, we encourage you as you seek to improve your future. Well, I mean, you know, they denied the kid going to college. So I guess, you know, he can improve his future all he wants, just not with them.
That would appear to be what the letter says, Andy.
Is there any recourse from them? I mean, I guess a college can choose to allow or not allow anybody that they want, right?
I wouldn't say that. I would say that there's always an internal grievance process that would likely not yield any positive results. But many times to go to court, you would need to exhaust that remedy. And then a lot of these questions that we deal with on the podcast, we truly don't know the answer to because there's no appellate case law to guide us. We don't know what would happen if a person had sufficient financial resources to litigate the issue of a publicly funded university denying someone admission. We know that universities deny people for academic reasons. We know that they have some latitude, but we don't know how far that latitude would go. If it would go, we would get into questions of how long, what are the specifics of the sex crime? How many years ago did it occur? What sort of rehabilitation has the young man achieved? And there's just too many unknowns here. And he probably lacks the wherewithal to litigate this, but we truly don't know whether my hunch is that this case law is going to develop as we go forward slowly in terms of denying people access to parks and all the different things that people publicly collectively contribute to. It's quite a shame that you can pay taxes for a public university and not be allowed to access the university system. And that seems like that's what's going to happen no matter which university he applies to. I mean, if he applies to another public college, he's likely to get the same result.
Have you seen this get litigated in other situations, and do you know the results either way?
I don't know of any litigation. Hopefully one of our listeners will tell us that they know of. I don't know of anyone being denied admission and having litigated the issue. We're just beginning to see a litigation in terms of park denials and all the public places that people are not allowed to go. Illinois has a great system of restricting people from everything, from lakes to parks to, I mean, you name it, and they're restricted, and it's a lifetime ban in Illinois. It's not just for the duration of registration. It's a permanent ban, as I understand it.
And we know that as far as recidivism rate goes, education, job, family, those are massive, massive, massive predictors of recidivism. So more education, more family support, more job opportunities. So here we have a school that's actually like in cahoots with the idea of, well, maybe we should just send them all back to prison.
Well, I would say that that you would want the ideal candidate for litigation, and you would want to have one, because you always want to argue that maybe they have the right to do it, but they have to narrowly tailor. They have to specifically, it's like the conditions of supervision, for example. We keep saying, well, yes, they can have significant internet restrictions, but they can't have a blanket ban, and they have to narrowly tailor. There again, depending on the specifics of this, this might be an appropriate rejection, lacking specificity in terms of what the offense was. But it might be totally inappropriate because it may be totally unrelated to the university population. You don't have a lot of minors around university campuses, do you?
No, not normally. There might be one or two that get, you know, early admissions when they're 16 and they're a savant or something.
But if this were, for example, if this were a Romeo and Juliet offense, where there was only a slight difference in age, in one of those states where they ding you even if you're even close in age, if it's a minor, that might not be make a good candidate. If it was a possession of porn underage. You just go carefully analyze, and you want to get the best candidate for litigation. You probably don't want to just go willy nilly with anybody you can find, which is what we caution against. When I'm on the NARSL litigation review committee, we're looking very carefully at how well the plaintiff has been selective, how well the candidate for making the challenge is, because even though it shouldn't, as I said, we don't live in the world the way it should be. We're in the world the way it is be, and judges are human, and they're going to look at those factors that they shouldn't look at. So we want to have the most attractive candidate we can. But I would love to see litigation move forward in this. The only thing that keeps holding us back on all this stuff is what, Andy?
It's going to be, let's see here, big cars. Hang on, more groceries. No, it's just going to be flat out cash.
That's the biggest barrier, is that this litigation is very costly because the governmental entities, regardless of whether you're fighting state or federal or even local, they have vastly superior resources, and they will fight tooth and nail to protect all this stuff. And the university system would come in with their attorney, with their legal team. They would be able to extinguish a person who was just haphazardly funded and organized, certainly a pro se person, they would probably extinguish, but they would extinguish the litigation pretty quickly if the person wasn't well prepared, because they have superior resources to work with.
Well, let's move on to this email message or voicemail message. This is from a new listener who's only been listening for a couple weeks, so I can't thank you enough I would actually reach out and let me know how you found us, and so we can try and traffic those areas to get more listeners. But here's a voicemail message.
Hey there. I'm going to remain anonymous. I am a registrant calling out of Virginia. I've been listening to the podcast for about a week now, and yes, I am very interested in becoming a Patreon. But I know I'm not the only one that's crying about the thing, because I know there were some people that didn't have to register at all, and then all of a sudden they're put on the registry. I did receive a letter last year stating that I could petition after 25 years to get off, but my main thing is I would just like to know if about the ex post facto law, and if that would have any effect on my situation.
So what do you have to say, Larry?
Well, I appreciate having the new listener, and I appreciate the question. And we do talk about from time to time, and that's the beauty of the podcast. We can come back and talk about it again. Ex post facto, the analysis of ex post facto only applies to criminal laws. And there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents a retroactive application of something that doesn't inflict punishment. And there's where it gets tricky. Because a regulatory scheme, if it's truly regulatory, not inflicting punishment, that can be applied retroactively. And that's what the Supreme Court said in Smith versus Doe, which is the landmark decision that still controls to this day. A relatively benign registry scheme, whether it would be 10 years and then they went back and added another 10 years to it, as long as it remained a benign, non-punitive requirement, that could be done. I know that's not folks saying that I approve of that. That's saying that from a constitutional perspective, it could be done. You could extend a regulatory requirement beyond the original time the regulation was required, as long as it remained punitive, because the ex post facto clause protects people from punishment. You could theoretically have a registration scheme that inflicted no punishment. And I've cited the example of what would happen if you simply were told to register upon conviction and mail in a form once a year. Never had any restrictions on where you live. Never had any restrictions on where you work. Never had any obligation to go in person to see anybody. The only thing you had to do is mail the form and notify them within 10 or 20 or 30 days of changing any of your residential information. That would be not a whole lot different than what you register when you register a car. You're supposed to register in most states within 30 days of becoming a resident. You're supposed to register your vehicle and convert your driver's license, and you're supposed to notify them when you change that information, usually within 30 days. I haven't heard anybody allege that that's punitive, and it's not. It's a regulatory measure. Well, you could have a registry for sex offenders that was equally benign. Unfortunately, most of the registries are far more than just what I described. But until the registry requirements of your state have been challenged sufficiently with a well-developed case showing how that those requirements have evolved to inflict punishment, they are assumed to be regulatory. And that's the stated purpose of the registry, and that's what the courts have said time and time again. Until the last 10 years, the courts have begun to look at the ever-increasing requirements, and they have said, well, no, this is no longer regulatory. You're being required to do too many things, and it resembles too much like probation supervision, and probation supervision is punitive. Therefore, you can't. So in terms of the question about the Supreme Court looking at this term, I don't know of a case that they've granted review that deals specifically with ex post facto. I just don't know what he's talking about. I know that there's a case that that's on cert petition from North Carolina, a Bethea case. And I know a case that has to do with delegation. But that has nothing to do with ex post facto, although people would like that they would like for it to be about ex post facto. It has to do with the delegation clause. So I'm not familiar with what he's talking about. But in terms of Virginia, I happen to believe the Virginia register is punitive. Anybody who's on it would agree that it's punitive, but it has to be proven in a court, either state or federal court, that's the case. The courts are not roving tribunals looking for a dispute to settle. There has to be a party that's aggrieved And the party has to bring the complaint through the proper process and build an evidentiary record and prove and show by the clearest of proof that the Constitution is being violated. It's not the state's job to prove anything. It's the challenging party's responsibility to prove it. That means registrants in Virginia are going to have to make the challenge and put forth the proof that their registry has evolved and transformed to be punitive. Hope that answers a little bit of what he's getting at.
So can we move, excuse me, can we move up the scale just a little bit? So you talked about just like mailing in a form once a year. What would be, and I'm asking, and this is totally your opinion, what would move it from being just regulatory to something resembling punishment? Is it that we go to the police station? Is it that we get booked, like we're being convicted of something or charged with something? Where does that line get crossed? Is it the number of times per year that it happens? Where do you think it crosses that line?
It's not real clear because of all the decisions where the line has been crossed, and there's a number of them. There's the Wallace case out of Indiana. There's the Letelaine case out of Maine. There's the Starkey case out of Oklahoma. There's the Doe versus Snyder case out of Michigan. And I mean, I can go on and on with a little bit of thought of where the registry has been declared to have crossed the line. The only recent case is still on appeal out of Colorado in the Millard versus Rankin case. It's not clear that there is, because under the Supreme Court's guidance, there's seven factors. That's called the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez test, and they don't tell you exactly where, how much to weight each of the seven factors, and one or two of the factors are not even relevant. But the one I lean most heavily to is disabilities or restraints. It's, does the requirement impose any disability or restraint? Well, in the Smith versus Doe analysis, if you look at that decision from page 100 of the case, there was no disability or restraint imposed by the Alaska regulatory scheme back in 2003 when the court was looking at it. That's not the case these days. There are tremendous disabilities of restraint. You look at the Doe versus Snyder case out of Michigan. They said the 2006 and 2011 changes clearly transformed to be punitive. And Michigan has residency restrictions, and they changed the duration of registration, which is what this gentleman's complaining about, and they changed the frequency of reporting, which is what he's complaining about. It very well could be that the line has been crossed in Virginia. And we just don't know. But I lean more toward the disability restraint. If the court says we find this is constitutional because it does not do these things, to me, the logical conclusion would be once they start doing those things, that's contrary to what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Smith versus Doe. Now, I'm not the brightest person around, but that to me seems like it's pretty clear cut. We uphold this because it doesn't do this. If it's doing this, it seems like to me all you have to do is go back and litigate and say the Supreme Court said you could do this as long as you didn't do these things. They're now doing these things, so based on Smith versus Doe, you cannot continue to do this while running afoul of the ex post facto clause. That is what I would argue. Can't guarantee it'll work, but I can guarantee it won't if you don't.
Yeah, definitely that. And then we're back to finding attorneys to help bring the challenge, and you need Paul Dubling caliber attorneys. You can't just get a run-of-the-mill attorney that's going to fight this, and you need a six-figure bankroll, right?
That's what you need, and unfortunately, that's not available to most registrants, and we understand that. They end up wanting to go back to their public defender, and they want to challenge what's the civil regulatory scheme. And the public defenders are not allowed to do that, so they end up with a very limited challenge that they can do, mostly by violating the registry. And then they put forth a motion to dismiss, claiming that the registry has evolved to be punitive. And the trial judge that's going to be trying them on the charge of violating some violation of the registry finds that it's not punitive. They just simply regurgitate Smith versus Doe and say it's not punitive, and they move on without an evidentiary record. To do this right, you're going to have to bring a civil action which where the civil courts are set up to develop evidence. That's what they do in civil disputes. And you build an evidentiary record. You put the state on trial and you call witnesses and you cross-examine their witnesses and you take depositions. You do things that cost money. You really can't do much of that in a criminal setting. But unfortunately, that's how a lot of registration challenges are brought us through the criminal process. So that's not ideal. And the results are usually not good.
Interesting. That's really, really interesting. I'm sure we're going to come back around on that issue at some point in time in the future. Let's try and cover some articles before we've run out of time. So this week was interesting that the effects of a law being signed into place around April. It's called it's FOSTA and SESTA, which I know that the SESTA one is the sex trafficking something or another. Look up FOSTA, F-O-S-T-A or S-E-S-T-A, and you'll find all the information about it. And I have some information in the show notes. But both Facebook and Tumblr, and maybe you guys remember, we would have covered this, that Craigslist pulled down their personal ads. It's all related to that, that the government has decided that anything that it's Section 230 of the FOSTA-SESTA side of things, that a content provider, so a Facebook, anybody like that, if they have sexually explicit content, they have been exempt from being prosecuted for having, you know, some sort of questionable content, whether that's pornography or moving it on down to like child pornography. But there are a lot of people who work in an industry, you know, in the sex industry, cam shows or sex chat, and they provide these services. But now places like Tumblr and Facebook have now started, they've removed all the content. And this is now, I mean, in my opinion, if two consenting adults want to do it, let them do it. But here, these operations have taken their content off because there is then a threat of a government challenge to bring them up on charges of having this stuff. So this is totally like puritanical government overreach, in my opinion.
Well, this is an example of where you have that great bipartisanship of the conservatives and the liberals. They conservatives, because usually they come at this from a more moral point of view, and the liberals on this, there's the victimization of to make these they're theoretically trying to target those that are below the age of where they can voluntarily be the content sometimes is underage. That's their allegation, that the content of what's on Tumblr is underage. And therefore, people are being victimized. So you get the victims and their advocates together, and you get the conservatives who believe we should be pure as a society, and you get bad public policy. So that's an example of your great bipartisanship that you strive for at work, because I can just about guarantee you, I didn't look at the votes, but I just about guarantee you that this would have been unanimously approved by Democrats and Republicans and sent to President Trump. And like I say, any president who gets this stuff, they're going to sign it. I can't be any more consistent than I've been about that. Whatever president's in office, if he's getting something to protect children, to stop exploitation of children, they are going to sign it.
Even
regardless.
Well, I mean, but even in the case of someone that is doing some kind of legitimate work, however you want to word that, and they're an adult and it's consenting and they didn't get extorted into it, they didn't get sex trafficked into it, you have... I heard actually driving up here that you've taken away where they are known. Now they are moving into places unknown. And wouldn't it be better for the government to like just put their finger on the pulse of something and know that all the bad things are happening in this place instead of going to shut it down? You could just use that as not entrapment, but just as the place where you know that this is going on, and you could not regulate it, but just monitor it and know, you know, if you find the kiddie porn, go out there and arrest the people that have posted the kiddie porn. If somebody's doing something legit and offering sex chat for 5 cents a post, I don't know, then let them run it. Have fun.
Well, that's a decadent society that allows people to engage in cam shows and all that kind of vile stuff. I mean, what the hell's wrong with you?
Is that would that violate your supervision conditions? Is that watching porn?
Well, I don't think watching a cam show would be considered porn in my book. It's not been porn. Isn't that recorded? If you're looking at porn, you're looking at a magazine or you're looking at a video. But if you're looking at live, that's just simply a cam show.
I can't even contain myself. I'm laughing so hard. I can't argue with you, but I have to think that there's no condition that a supervising person would come in and look at you and you're like, "Hey man, I'm just watching a cam show. These two people are live or one person, whatever." And they'd be like, "Oh, sure, man, that's no problem." Because you're not watching porn. Do you have any porn on your phone? Nope. What's all this cam show stuff? That's live. It's not on my phone.
Well, now they generally have broad enough conditions to say that you can't watch any live performance as well. But if they didn't have that and they just said can't watch porn, then you get into a nuanced discussion about what constitutes porn. And that's what the court many years ago, I can't define it, but I sure know it.
Yeah, that's what they said in the Supreme Court.
Well, so don't know, forget, define it, but I know it when I see it. But a cam show is not porn. I don't know why you don't understand
they
that.
They also say that you can't dial 900 numbers, but if you find someone that you can, like, if you can have a live conversation with someone that has some naughty words, but you couldn't text message someone with naughty words, how is that different?
I'm not sure on that. I don't even know there's a 900 number still in existence out
there.
Well,
okay. So for those of you that don't know what a 900 number is, do you think there's anybody listening that doesn't know what a 900 number is?
I would think there's a heck of a lot of people who don't know what 900 numbers are.
2000, maybe they would have died. It was a way for you to dial a phone number and it would reverse the charges instead of you placing a collect call where it would be billed to the other side. But you were paying for a service and you'd pay, I don't know, $2.99 a minute, $15 for the first minute and $2.99 for each minute after that or something like that.
It was a racket, I can tell you that. But yes, it was a paid service. But that was in the days when it was able to be put on your phone bill and collected through the company that ran the 900 service. They would interface with the local telephone company, which probably less than half the people have a land-based line anymore, and it could be charged to it. But that was the days where you got everything on your phone bill.
So a little personal story. I was, I don't know, 12 or 13, and my father had some naughty magazines, and in the back of the magazine, there was like, you know, pages and pages and pages and pages. I think
I hear this coming.
I think I ran up about $600 of phone bills in, you know, and this was 1983 or 4 or 5 or something like that. My parents were not happy.
Well, now, when you were making the calls, did you realize there was going to be a charge, or was it not clear?
I would have to say, I'm sure it was clear, but I didn't understand. I didn't understand the rules of the game. And, you know, hey, man, you're just picking up the phone. You called your friend down the street. You called your grandma. Like, there was no consequences for that. Why can't you call some naughty chick readings? And, you know, it was just a tape recorder, right? You're just hearing a naughty message on a tape. I wasn't talking to anybody.
Well, and it was, and how did those charges get paid for?
I grew up in a pretty well-to-do house, so I don't think it was any issue on actually paying the bill. I think it was an issue of, like, damn, dude, you're stupid.
So, well, I remember, now this goes back when we had, I lived in a rural area, and we had black rotary phones that were on the wall.
I remember those days.
And most people had them in the kitchen, and they were beginning to push out direct dial, and you could, everybody at one time dialed operator to make a long distance call, and they were saying you could dial one in the number, and I was convinced, because I was only in my single years, maybe 9, 10, I was very young, and I was convinced that you could dial that and it wouldn't know that you were doing it, and I made a long distance call. And so when the bill came through, it was like $1.35 or whatever. I had some explaining to do about where that call went and what the purpose of it was, because it wasn't that far. When I say long distance, you could be calling a very short geographic distance, but if you were outside the toll-free area, and Atlanta had a large toll-free area, but we were outside it, you could only be calling from Covington to Conyers. If you called beyond Conyers, it was a long-distance call into Atlanta. You could call from Covington to Conyers, and it was local. Then if you went to the next town up to Lithonia, it was long-distance.
All right, so somebody in the chat just gave us like one of their conditions. It says, sexually-oriented material. You shall not possess or subscribe to any sexually-oriented or sexually-stimulating material to include mail, computer, or television, nor patronize any place where such material or entertainment is available.
Well, that would be broad enough that that would cover most everything. But we were just having a discussion about whether it's porn. Well, it's not porn, but it is sexually stimulating.
Maybe. It might be, it might, maybe it's not for you.
Well, it is for me. That's why I mean.
All right, then.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
So let's go on to this next article. And this is on the heels of the First Step Act. So the Congressional Budget Office, which is, I guess, like a nonpartisan group, and they digest all the information on how a bill is going to affect the government. And so if you follow the stuff, the health care bill, it was supposed to increase costs by this, but then reduce it over time and all this. But they said on the heels of the First Step Act that the CBO predicted that the faster release of inmates would increase the number of people benefiting from federal programs like Medicare and Social Security, since inmates are generally ineligible for many federal assistance programs while serving time. I don't think that you can get your nut check while you're locked up, right?
That is correct. And the people who exit the system when they're properly exiting the system, they can, if they were receiving Social Security, retirement, survivors, or disability, it would be, have been suspended while they're in prison. It's an amazing situation where they don't catch that, because the Social Security Administration is notified of the Social Security number of everybody who's in custody. When you're in custody, in all likelihood, your benefits are going to be terminated.
And so they said that would increase direct federal government spending by $346 million and reduce revenue by $6 million, also from 2019 to 2028. So $346 million over 10 years, so $34 million a year. Like, considering that we have a $5 trillion budget, that's kind of a drop in the hat.
Well, it's kind of hard to know. I suspect that there'll be things that will be people eligible for, like the states that have adopted. It's difficult to know who, when they leave federal prison, exactly where they're going to go back to. But you may have states who have expanded their Medicaid to capture the 100% federal payment for the expanded population, which dropped to 90%. If you knew exactly where they're going to go, and they're going to be eligible for Medicaid right away, that would add to the federal spending, because the federal government is still picking up 90% of that. So some of this is just throwing in the dark. But what it illustrates the bigger point. When people talk about all this money that will be saved, it's kind of like when they talk about all the money that the registry will save if they just simply had a risk-based system. Well, when you let people out of prison, they don't magically go to work. And oftentimes, they'll end up on a benefit of some type because of lack of employability, and they'll either go back onto the Social Security system if they're old enough, they'll seek disability benefits if they have enough recent work history, or they'll go into SNAP and they'll go on to any type of benefit that they can. So it illustrates the bigger point that what we really need to be doing, which is what we've talked about on podcasts before, is to make prison resemble the outside world as much as we can, and have transferable talent that goes with the prisoner when they go out the door, with reintegration assistance into the workforce, with trying to make sure that they don't go on the dole, which is what's missing in this CBO analysis. I'd like to see the other half of it done, which is of this population that are leaving, that 64% of them are under or within their prime working age years, and that they should be reintegrated into the workforce and be paying taxes, and how much additional revenue we would have. That part of it's missing. They're just looking at the negative side of how many of them will seek benefits. But we can do something about that if we only have the will.
And the First Step Act was the whole kit and caboodle, and everything is fixed on the federal criminal justice system now?
No, that's why they call it First Step. I think people realize that it was a minute first step, and there was a lot of pushback, and a lot of concessions had to be made to get that passed. We were going to have to go through this. Was it was another election cycle or two? All life as we know it, if it ends, and criminality, the crime rate doesn't skyrocket, perhaps we can go back and build upon the First Step Act, but preparing people for prison and getting them back into the workforce is of paramount importance. We don't want to release people to go onto the public assistance doles of some type. We want to release people with transferable job skills and become taxpayers. That's my idea. I agree with Senator Lindsey Graham on that one. They need to be working.
Absolutely. This article then comes from Fox 17 out of Nashville, the wonderful state of Tennessee. Here's a man who spent 11 years in jail based on the testimony of a 12-year-old and a report that said he could be a DNA match. I think that could be is a key element there. And after all that time served, during that time, his 15-year-old son, I think it said, was had committed suicide. And then through processes, he was exonerated. He said completely exonerating Mr. Mills based on DNA evidence. But the parole board there in Tennessee will not take him off their rolls. And I'm still kind of baffled at how he can be, he's completely exonerated that he didn't do this crime. He couldn't have been involved in the crime, yet the parole board there will not let him off of the registry requirements there.
Well, it's not clear in the article either. It says the parole board, in quote, seems to see prosecutors, judges, and the entire legal system. You would assume that DNA completely exonerating Mr. Mills would at least get a hearing, but when the parole board determined he doesn't even merit a hearing, it's impossible to explain, said, I guess that's the attorney, Daniel Horowitz. It baffles me as well. I'm at a loss to explain it.
Did you say that they can second-guess the whole legal system?
Well, that's what the quote from Mr. Horowitz says here in the article.
That's bizarre. Like, I thought that they would be the final. I mean, exonerating means like, hey, can we roll the clock back and start over? There, like, we just need to go back to square one, right? I mean, that's what exoneration means.
That's what I'm thinking, but it's not clear that the exoneration is complete.
Didn't something like that happen in Georgia? And the Georgia Supreme Court ruled, I want to say, wasn't that the case that Brandon Thomas had worked on? Do you know?
I don't remember.
I seem to remember something vaguely similar, that someone had their sentence squashed and the parole board said, nah, you were convicted, so you get to stay on the registry here in Georgia. And eventually the Georgia Supreme Court said, no, that's garbage, because exoneration means that you should have never been convicted in the first place. So how would you end up on the registry then?
I think I vaguely remember that. Well, this is certainly one we'd want to try to follow and figure out. But it's bizarre that he can't get off of the registry, and he's been cleared as an impossible, that he couldn't have committed the crime. Well, see, and that's one of the things where I always find it troubling prosecutors. If it's been proven impossible, it would seem like to me that the prosecutor, because they have a special higher duty of ethics, if you look at the Code of Professional Conduct, it would seem like the prosecutor, which they never do, seldom, but the prosecutor would want to clear this person's name and want this person to go back to normal life. That's what I would think.
Yeah, but how? I mean, like, even normal life. So, okay, fine. You somehow can restore the guy's 11 years of life, but in there, his kid committed suicide because dad was in prison, and he just felt, you know, whatever the kid was going through as far as dad's abandoned me and so forth. I mean, if he was 15 years old, the kid was, you know, 4 years old when dad got locked up. So right when the kid is becoming something of a functional entity and not just a little bundle of goo, you know, dad's not there, dad's in prison, you're visiting dad in prison, trying to go through the whole shakedown process. They're doing cavity searches on the kid, going into jail to visit dad, and the kid can't handle it all. I mean, how do you can't undo that. I mean, that seems like that would be even grounds for a massive lawsuit against the state, too.
Well, I hope so, and maybe some of our Tennessee people will tell us more, but it's the bizarrest thing I've ever seen.
Well, this is going to be kind of an off-the-cuff conversation. You brought up something to me roughly a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, about the system being designed to target certain kinds of individuals. And there is a faction of people going around saying that the system is designed to target homosexuals. And I found an article that I ultimately agree with you that the system is not designed to target homosexuals. But that doesn't mean that there aren't humans that then twist how the system works to target whatever class of people that is. And so I found this article that talks about people in Texas where there are murder convictions, and then the whole operation there, where the families can't get any evidence behind how their child was killed, or their family member was killed. And the reason why I chose this article as like the reason behind it is because the system itself has policies and processes and things in place to help. I don't think that the system is designed, or there are checks and balances in the system to help people, counter against the system. However, if there are enough things inside of the system that push back, and I know I'm being really vague, but if the whole police system is corrupt, talk like, I don't know, 1950s or something, like police force, mafias run around, the police just do whatever they want, there's no checks and balances. And this article has, it's a long article out of Reason magazine, and there's this police force that the families can never get information about how their child was killed. And so anyway, like what I'm getting at is I wanted you to speak to this whole thing where there's a group of people that think that the system is designed to target homosexuals. How is that for a vague,
Wow.
completely amorphous, non-specific introduction?
You're trying to have me assassinated, aren't
Not
you?
necessarily. We can cut it if you want to.
So, well,
I'm not being specific about it.
well, I've heard that for a long time, and I don't see the evidence that supports it. I see evidence that supports that individuals within the system misuse their power. I would be foolishly naive to think that if I said that people who work in prisons don't take advantage of or cause people who are of LGBT community to be mistreated, I would be foolish to say that police officers, when you're talking about a criminal case, it goes through dozens and dozens of people from its trajectory from the time that the original first phone call report to the police, the reporting field officer, to the detectives bureau, to the review by the intake at the district attorney and prosecution office, to the actual prosecutor, the defense attorney, the judge, the pre-sentence report at the probation office. There's just so many steps. It would be absurd to think that somebody who didn't have an anti-gay bias did not touch that case. Because the most liberal numbers of the gay population is in single digits, so that means 90+% of the people are not. So of course you're going to find people who have those biases and who are going to let them impact what they're doing. But I've not been convinced that when the people made the laws, they sat around and said, "All righty, boys and girls, we've got a problem with older men targeting teenage boys for sex. So therefore, we're going to make it against the law for adults to have sex with teenagers, but it only goes for boys. We don't care about if it's girls or if it's girl on girl or whatever. It's just we find it disgusting that these homosexual men are targeting these teenage boys." Now, even though I don't see any evidence of that, I do see evidence of people who work the system deliberately going out of their way to target prosecution because they have that law in the books, and they use that because of their own personal bias. But that's not the system that designed that way. That's the actual practice of the practitioners. And maybe I'm being a bit naive, but I've not been convinced that the system was designed I don't think that the system was designed that way. I think that's the result of human frailties and imperfections and biases and prejudices.
Isn't that the, I mean, if we go to the Ron Book stuff in Florida, it's not against just boys. I mean, that was a female nanny or babysitter or whatever that was accused of messing with Lauren Book. So, I mean, it's not targeting just boys. It's that brings into evidence that there's a female component there too.
Yeah, and then one of the hottest, at least from the male perspective, hottest sex offenders on the registry in Florida. Her name's escaping me at the moment, but she got national notoriety. It was a teacher and a teenage boy.
We also had the case, like there was the teacher. This was like New England.
In Connecticut.
Yeah. Just less than a year ago, because we covered it on the podcast. She was 22 and he was 18. I guess that's not kids, but he was, you know, still under like the child relationship, teacher-student relationship.
Yeah, I think it's like Debbie LaFay or something, and the one in Florida was so notorious back in 10 years ago. But I just don't. I see the result, and I'm convinced the result. But I'm not convinced that the people who created the laws were in some cloak of secrecy trying to target homosexuals. Now, if the evidence serves, I'm a big believer in evidence. If someone can bring me the evidence, I'll buy into the scheme. But I just I say there's result and there's cause. The results, I'm convinced. But I don't know that was that we get those results because that was the plan. I think the results because that's the people. And you could probably address this better than me. How come it is that so many guys, when they wear that police uniform or any type of uniform, and they find it so objectionable that two guys would be kissing or touching each other, and they're so turned on that two women are doing the same thing. And since the majority of the police officers and law enforcement are men, that would explain some of the bias right there. But I can't explain why you guys look at things that way. Why is it you so find it so revolting that two guys are getting it on? Can you tell me that?
I can't explain it, and I think about it often, and I just go, eh. I just have to accept it. If I like one and not the other, but then I'm being a hypocrite. So I try to not be a hypocrite. So if it's a turn on for two guys to kiss, enjoy. Not my thing. Two girls kissing? God, is that the hottest thing ever. Unless, of course, they're really ugly females. And that's not to offend anybody, but I'm just saying.
Okay, so it's okay, but it's not hot.
It is not a
turn on. So you would not use your powers to prosecute. So if you're an officer and you rolled up on two guys making out in a car, you would give them every bit of the break that you did the two girls. Now, because it's just as illegal to be doing that in public. Would you give them the same break? Would you say, you guys need to get dressed and get out of here before I have to take you in? Or would you do what typically a male chauvinist would do and say, well, I ain't going to put up with any of that around here. I got this badge on and I'm going to do my job and I'm going to have to run y'all in.
I can say that I would not lock them up. I would tell them to get on their way. But if the two girls making out, you know, who knows? Maybe we hang out for a while.
Oh, I see.
By the way, this Deborah LaFay, if that's her name, she is a good looking lady. And she is serving 5 to 15 years for having sex with a 14-year-old student while she was married and while she was a teacher.
And I'll tell you this, her husband that she was married to was a sexy man. So I don't know what she was seeing in the teenage boy, but she already had good stuff already.
Yeah, she may have had something good like in presentation, but maybe there was something lacking on the other side of things.
Well, if you're getting turned on by taking a 15-year out to a foil that are freezing or something that's all fruit that the young people drink. Not for a smoothie.
Oh, okay. Taking the kid out for a smoothie instead of getting a beer?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's what she was doing. She was taking. Well, she wasn't giving him alcoholic beverages. There was no evidence of that. She at least bought him smoothies.
Yeah. She was sentenced in 2006 to 3 years house arrest and 7 years probation. Good grief, man. That's not really – that doesn't sound – the Wikipedia page said something different than the AJC.
Yeah, it was community controls, what they call it.
God, why do you know this?
The house arrest.
Why do you know that?
I get paid to know that.
Oh, okay, is that what you're paid for by Registry Matters?
Yes, that's the I'm supposed to know things.
All right then. Well, Larry, I had moved a bunch of articles to the bottom. That is all we have for this evening. And so we have to make some adjustments in how we announce the phone number. How do people get in touch with us?
Well, they have options, but if they choose the old-fashioned option, they call us at area code 747-227-4477. And if you didn't catch that, I'll repeat it, and then you can do the replay, 747-227-4477.
Is there a website that someone could go to find all of this information?
They could. They could go to registrymatters.co.
And how about if they want to shoot us an email message?
That would be fantastic, and they could do that at registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And if somebody wants to support the podcast and show all the love and appreciation for the work that we do here at Registry Matters, how do they do that?
They contact me directly for my personal account number to wire the funds to.
I got it. All right. What is the alternate method?
I think there's something about Patreon, patreon.com/registrymatters.
This is, we are recording this on the 29th of December. So in 2 days, it is going to roll the clock. So in 2 days and 4 hours, it's going to roll the clock into 2019.
And we're going to be having a happy new year with fantastic growth. I think we're actually going to be recording next week. It's the week after I'm going to be traveling. So next week, we'll be on a normal record schedule.
Okay. Groovy. So if anybody wants to chime in on Discord and listen to us record this live and laugh at us or ask questions while we're recording, feel free. We record somewhere around 7 o'clock Eastern time, and the links are at the website at registrymatters.co to get into Discord. And if you're friendly and all that, maybe you can say hi and you know, have your 10 minutes of fame. With all that, though, Larry, I wish you a very, very, very happy new year, a prosperous 2019, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy. Good night.